Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Gerard Sweeney presents Live on Era in association with emeraldconnection.net.
Live on Era, presented by Gerard Sweeney.
You're probably sick of me at this stage. No, I wasn't talking to you. I was talking generally. Anyway, good evening and welcome. It's nice to have your company on Live on Era this evening. Thank you for tuning our way. I say that you must be sick of listening to me because I was with you earlier on today for Giles. I'll be back again tomorrow and Friday for him as well. Anyway, thank you very much to Howard for Spain today. Howard, if you're still listening in, have yourself a very pleasant evening. Hopefully you and Luna will be doing something nice and enjoy it. And we look forward to hearing all about the marijuana tomorrow, if that's what you're going to tell us all about it, all right? Between 6 and 7 for another edition of Spain Today. So here we are, live on air at the Irish programme. I've got, I've got a nice programme lined up for you, I think. I know I do, and I hope that you will agree with me. Mary Connolly O'Sullivan is no stranger to the programme. We've had her on the programme twice, maybe before. And she headed off to Amsterdam recently and she came back with another award. And we're going to find out exactly what that is for. And we might even take a listen to the reason behind it as well. For those of you who don't know, Mary is a soprano. She's based in Killarney in County Kerry. And as I said, has been on the programme before. So that will be a conversation that I'm looking forward to very much in the first hour of the programme. And in the second hour, I'm going to be talking to Jason O'Toole. In fact, I've spoken to Jason because we did the interview yesterday around lunchtime. And Jason is the author, he's a journalist, but he's the author of a book which is titled The Gilligan Tapes. And the book is also, it forms the basis, the tapes form the basis of a 3-part documentary series about John Gilligan, one of Ireland's most notorious gangsters, criminals. And a man that was in the news in Spain and in Ireland only on Monday of this week because he was before the courts in Torrevieja in relation to drugs offences, but was given a suspended sentence and walked free from the court. There has been a lot of reaction to the Gilligan tapes, the book and the series. And it has been, it hasn't all been positive insofar as people don't think that Gilligan should be given the oxygen that he's given. But that's something that I raise with Jason. So that's an interesting conversation that you will hear in the second hour of the programme. I have some new music in there as well. I have music definitely going to fit in Ben Cutler's new single. Ben is from Belfast. Martin Pretorius is Martin. I got a single from PJ Curtis last week or before last week's programme, and Martin's living in County Cork. He released a new single on the 1st of September. I just ran out of time to play it last week, so I'm going to play it. And Des Egan, again, somebody that you will be familiar with from the programme. Des was in touch as well. He's got a beautiful new single, and you'll be hearing that in the first hour of the programme as well. So there you go. That's what we have for you. Will you stay? Lovely. Put the kettle on if you like. And look, it's all going to be nice and relaxed and chilled out. If you'd like to get involved for any reason, give out to me for any reason, you can join the club. You can send a WhatsApp to +34 645 996795 as per usual, or send an email to either studio@tre.radio or to me, ger@tre.radio. News that broke this afternoon, the government has decided to hold 2 referendums. Is it referenda or referendums? Well, this article says referendums, so we'll go with that. On the issue of gender equality, that's according to Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. However, the wordings for both still have to be finalised. Speaking after Cabinet today, Mr. Varadkar said that he was committed to holding them sooner rather than later, and certainly in the lifetime of this government. The votes are scheduled for November November, and Mr. Varadkar said that he would meet the Electoral Commission CEO Art O'Leary in the coming weeks. The possibility of multiple questions to change the constitution has been under consideration for some time. You know how we love to talk about the weather in Ireland? Yes, well, as I look out the window, I can see patches of blue sky. It's been a lovely day. There was a little sprinkling of rain earlier on, but nothing. It didn't develop into anything. There's some cloud there, and there's a gentle little breeze blowing, making the leaves on the trees quiver ever so slightly. But Met Éireann, which is our weather forecasting facility, or Met Éireann has issued a status yellow high temperature warning for Ireland. The forecaster says that the weather will be very warm and humid tomorrow and Friday. Daytime temperatures will climb to in excess of 27 degrees Celsius in many areas away from coasts, with nighttime temperatures not falling below 15 degrees. This could lead to heat stress, uncomfortable sleeping conditions, and there is a risk of water-related incidents. Now, the protracted warm spell comes after Ireland had its warmest ever June, followed by the wettest ever July, and experienced a very unsettled August with storms Francis and Betty causing flash flooding. Now, provisional data indicates that it was the fifth warmest summer since records began in 1900 and the eighth wettest summer since 1941. Met Éireann says that the current warm spell is being caused by a number of hurricanes, tropical storms and depressions in the Atlantic, pumping warmer air into the upper atmosphere, allowing high pressure to build in from the east. That's what they say. That's all right, because I was hoping I was going to get the grass cut. I'm heading back to Spain on Friday night. We're going driving back. And I wanted to get the grass cut before I go. So it's grand, I can leave it until Friday. And we'll get it done and dusted then at that stage. Or we might do it tomorrow. It was a case of 42nd time lucky for Ronan Dalton. Who's he now? Well, he's the man who claimed victory in the Liffey Swim in one of the closest races in years. The 60-year-old swimmer from the Half Moon Club in Dublin touched the finish line first after a grueling 2.2-kilometre course from the Guinness Brewery to the Custom House. He finished everywhere in the top 10 over the years, but never finished first. So he said that it was an extra special result this year for him. This year as well, as the Half Moon Club is celebrating its 125th anniversary, and Ronan is this year's president. Oh, that makes it nice. So there'll be multi celebrations. The women's race was won by Roseanne Marshall from the Guinness Swimming Club. More than 500 swimmers took part in the event, which was the 103rd running of the race. So well done to everybody. Don't think I'd like to be swimming in the Liffey. No, definitely wouldn't. A team of underage rugby players from Kinsale in County Cork are preparing to travel to France tomorrow to represent their club and their country at a mini World Cup tournament held in Provence. The under-12s from Kinsale Rugby Club will have to beat teams from Italy, Switzerland and Monaco in their group games to progress to the knockout stages of the tournament. Kinsale Rugby Club is a junior club catering for players from under six to adults and is located at spectacular grounds at Snugmore overlooking Kinsale Harbour. That must be lovely. It has more than 500 members. The club is home to Europe's biggest rugby sevens tournament, which is played there every May bank holiday weekend. For the past year, the club's under 12 team has been training and fundraising to represent the club at the underage rugby tournament of the world. The underage rugby tournament of the world in Provence. The tournament is being held to coincide with the Rugby World Cup, which, as you know, begins on Friday. A group of around 50 players, coaches and parents will fly from Dublin to Marseille tomorrow evening before travelling to Provence, where the tournament will be held over 5 days. 8 teams are participating in the tournament. France, England, New Zealand and Spain will make up one pool, with Ireland, Italy, Monaco and Switzerland in the second pool. London Irish Rugby Club under-12s will be representing England. So there we go. There's a double reason for us to be cheering. The top teams, and Spain of course, yes, the top teams in each group will play in quarterfinals and semi-finals, with the winners of these playing in a tournament final. In addition to a heavy schedule of training, the team and their parents have been fundraising for months, with everything from bingo nights to bagpacking in local supermarkets. Isn't that lovely? Brilliant, absolutely. And listen, we'll have one more and we'll stay with sports. Shane Lowry, as you will know by now, will contest his second Ryder Cup in Rome later this month after being named as one of the six wild cards by the European captain Luke Donald. Missing the cut at the Czech Masters last week meant that he could not qualify automatically. But he was still widely expected to be selected by Donald to tee it up in the Italian capital, despite an underwhelming 2023, which saw him drop 17 places in the world rankings. Donald has recently praised his enthusiasm for the competition and his energy around the team room. Lowry won 1 point from three matches in his Ryder Cup bow in 2021, as the United States prevailed 19-9 at Whistling Straits against Porrick Harrington, captained Europe. Sepp Straka, as you probably know, Nikolaj Højgaard and Ludvig Åberg will make their first appearances. Tommy Fleetwood, Justin Rose have also been chosen. Rory McIlroy, Matt Fitzpatrick, Robert McIntyre, Tyrrell Hatton, Victor Hovland and John Rahm claimed the automatic slot. So we wish them well. Congratulations, one and all. And I hope that it goes jolly well for Europe. I think I was talking to somebody yesterday and I said, you know, it's America's to lose this year. I think because a lot of the American team has been very much in form over the last while. But you never know the way things go. It'll be nice if we could do it, wouldn't it? It'd be smashing. Looking forward to watching that, so I am. Right, music. Martin Pretorius, as I said, is living in County Cork. He has written a new single or a new song. It's called August. He released it on the 1st of September. Go figure. The change of season that probably makes us sentimental is the theme of it. So let's take a listen to Martin Pretorius.
I guess I've seen her face before. I can't remember when. The beauty in her wild green eyes, the shimmer of her skin, and how she moves so gently in that simple cotton dress. I can't help but lie awake at night and dream of her caress. A steady rain is falling, not a breeze is in the air. Oh, August, what have you become? You used to be so fair. You now look like a herald of the autumn coming soon. It seems like only yesterday when flowers were in bloom. Waves in those long summer days.
Isn't it? From a man by the name of Martin Pretorius, and a song that is called August. And you could hear the whole thing about the change of the seasons in there. Nice. And PJ Curtis was the man that sent that to me. If I'm not mistaken, PJ Curtis produced some albums for some people that Martin had produced for, I think, previously as well. If I'm remembering the email that you sent me, PJ, correctly. But anyway, there we go. Martin Pretorius and August. Right, quick break, and I have more news for you. And we've got more new music as well.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Here's a great story that I came across a couple of months ago, just at the start of the summer when the details were announced. A Spanish couple and their five children have relocated to a small Gaeltacht community on the Galway-Mayo border after being chosen to live there rent-free for 12 months. They were picked from over 1,000 applications in a bid to boost numbers at the local school and save it from closing. This is the big week for the Gaeltacht community in An Chloc Vreach. Scoldan Naoimh Patrick welcoming five new students from Spain, and they are very excited about it. The children range in age from 4 to 10 and are about to start an exciting new chapter in the close-knit rural community. The children's arrival means a 50% increase in student numbers, up from 10 to 15, which is helping to save a teacher and keep the school open in the long run or the long term. The family says that being picked to live in Ireland rent-free is the stuff of dreams. Isabel Fortes came to Galway as an au pair and returned to complete her master's degree. She now works at Boston Scientific. Her partner, Miguel Angel Ross, is a mechanic with a truck license and is looking for work. Isabel also has a degree in fine art. She says that painting is her passion and is confident that living on the West Coast in this rural community will inspire her. I'm sure it will. The family loves nature and like to go for long walks. Isabel is from a village in northern Spain, and the landscape is so similar to where they have now settled in Ireland, she says. Miguel is from Valencia and chuckles about having to get used to the wind and the rain in Ireland. You'll get used to it, Miguel. Apart from the weather, he says, he is thrilled to be starting a new life with his family in County Galway, and I hope that they get on really well. I did make contact with the school at the summertime, at the start of the summer, to say that I would love to come and have a chat with the family when they had settled, but I haven't heard back from them, and I knew there was no point chasing it because there was nobody in the school. So I'm going to let the dust settle, and we'll check in with them again over a period of time and see how they're getting on. All right, maybe before Christmas, it would be nice. RTE is projected to lose 21 million euro in license fee revenue this year. That's according to a briefing note that was being considered by the government. Minister for Media Catherine Martin was due to update ministers today on the financial decline at RTE and what interim funding would be required. The former Director General, Dee Forbes, had already sought 34 million euro in interim funding before the payments controversy emerged in June. Minister Martin said that the government wants to see absolute concrete reform at RTE in order to rebuild trust, adding that reform was already underway. She said that she could not say just yet just how much funding the government was prepared to allocate to RTE in order to make up for the precipitous decline in people paying their TV licence. RTE executives are due to attend a meeting of the Oireachtas Committee on Media next week about the ongoing difficulties at the station. And one more story that I think I'll bring to you. Speed limits on many roads are set to be reduced under plans being developed by government. It follows the recent rise in road fatalities after twice the number of people lost their lives on Irish roads last month compared to August 2022. There was 25 people. You heard me, 25 people died on the roads in Ireland in August alone. And I'm trying to think now, there was four were young people, there was two, there was six young people, seven, eight, there was about 10 of those were young people, you know, children or late teens. Anyway, speed limits, I said, okay, so where are we at? Minister of State at the Department of Transport, Jack Chambers, is working on a review that will soon go to government, which he believes will make a significant difference to lowering baseline speed limits. It would see speed capped at 80 kilometres per hour on national secondary roads, where the limit currently stands at 100 kilometres per hour. The limit on local and rural roads would drop from 80 to 60 kilometres per hour. Within town, cities and residential areas, there would be a limit of 30. while roads on the fringes of urban areas could be capped at 50 kilometres. The changes are part of an effort by Minister Chambers to address inconsistencies in speed limits across the country. The minister acknowledged that it will take significant time for local authorities to lower the limits and said that in the meantime, there will be an immediate response through a comprehensive strengthening of enforcement on the roads. Local authorities will be given detailed guidance on the new framework, he said, and it should be implemented throughout 2024 and into 2025. Now, what was I going to say? Oh, yes, Monday of this week was what they called a national slowdown day, where the guards basically said, look, we're going to be out with the radar. The go slow vans are going to be out. 865 people, despite the marketing campaign that went on, 865 people were found to be speeding. There was one that was mentioned, was it up around Drogheda, Dundalk? Individual doing 160 kilometres per hour in a 100 kilometres zone. Oh, wow. Education needed there, for sure and certain, indeed. Right. I got to keep going because we have lots of music that I want to get in and lots of good stuff as well. This man is based in Belfast. He's from Belfast as well. His name is Ben Cutler. Here's a song called Break the Ice, released last Friday, and in a new EP of the same name to be coming in October. We wish him well with it. Ben Cutler. We'll be right back. That's Ben Cutler from Belfast. That's a song that's called Break the Ice. It's the title track from a new EP coming in October. I think it's around the 19th of October, in around there anyway. I haven't listened to it all as yet. I've just heard that, the title track. I can't play any other tracks from it because it's embargoed. But as soon as I can, I will. That's a promise. All right, let's do a very quick break. And just after that, I'm going to be talking to Mary Cullity O'Sullivan in County Kerry. Mary is a wonderful soprano, and she went to Amsterdam recently and came back laden, dripping in awards. She'll tell us all about it just after this.
Live on Air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
It's always very nice to welcome a guest back onto the programme, but it's even nicer when that guest has got great news and awards. Mary Cullity O'Sullivan from County Kerry, congratulations and welcome back to Live on Air. How are you?
Hi, Ger. I am fantastic. Thank you so much for having me back on.
And why wouldn't you be fantastic? And you're dripping in awards.
Oh, yes. I've had such a fantastic weekend. Last weekend, I went to the Red Carpet Music Awards in Almelo in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And I won Best Voice once again with my song Stargazing.
Which we have played before, but we're going to play again.
Yes, you're very good. You have played it before. And yes, I won Best Voice last year as well, but they were only virtual awards, obviously, with COVID. There
yes.
was no awards actually happening in real life. And I also won Best Jazz Original that last year for my song Before You Leave Me.
Mm-hmm.
So this year, do you know, I said to my husband, we'll go for the weekend anyway.
Yeah.
And I've never been to Amsterdam. We said we'd go and enjoy it no matter. It was an excuse to buy the new Guna, the new dress.
And did you buy one yourself or was it just the husband?
Any excuse for me.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, tell me about these awards then. You know, you must have had fairly hectic competition if it's a European award.
Oh, massive competition. There were over 2,000 entries in all different categories and genres worldwide. There were over 200 winners in, obviously, there's different categories. There's Best Voice, there's Best Country, Gospel, Jazz, Blues, Best Production, Best Recording. It's massive. People came from all over the world. I've met people from Nashville, from Malaysia, obviously Germany, Holland, all over, English. I met a lovely girl from Ireland. She's a lovely country and western singer, Lorraine McCauley.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard her? Yeah, she's a beautiful, beautiful girl and a beautiful voice. And it was lovely to meet someone from Ireland as well. But yeah, the whole weekend, you know, it was lovely. Lovely people. There was a wonderful show. People got up and performed. And then we had the awards in between the performances. They called the different categories.
Lovely.
So my category was called on the Saturday night. I had nominations for Forever and a Day. That's one of my folk songs.
Right.
That was a nominated song. And Home for Christmas was nominated as well in the Christmas.
Oh, you're not talking about Christmas already, surely.
We won't feel the time.
Oh.
But yeah, so when my song Stargazing was called as a winner for Best Voice, oh my God, I couldn't believe it.
Fantastic.
So I hopped up and straight on the stage and I gave a small little speech.
Lovely.
Which everyone was delighted with. But, you know, it was wonderful to even go there and be recognised in Europe.
Mm. And who organises this then?
So, Peter and Gabby Agricola. They're a lovely Dutch couple. You know, they organise the whole thing. They're two wonderful people who have organised this from start to finish. They don't judge the competition. The competition is judged worldwide. Each song gets a number and it's just sent to the different judges. So obviously there's no cheating. So nobody can know your name.
Mm-hmm.
Or where you're from. Obviously the song gets a number. It's sent off to a panel of judges throughout the world. And obviously whoever gets the most ticks, I suppose, or the most votes within the judging community that song is deemed to be the winner, or The Voice is deemed to be the best. So that's what I loved about it. Do you know that nobody, it was kind of judging is blind, that nobody knows who you are or what you are.
In other words, if your next door neighbor was judging it, they wouldn't know it was you. Unless they knew The Voice.
Well, exactly. You'd be dropping them in a bottle of wine and say, pick me.
that's great. And tell me about the event itself. Were there many people there, and were there performances? Did you have to perform?
Oh, yes. There was a lot of people there. As I said, people came from all over the world. People came from America, Malaysia, around Europe. And a lot of people performed. Now, I was invited to perform, but I had an accident in January.
Okay.
And I'm fully healed, but I hit my head in the ice, silly me, going out.
Okay.
And basically, it took me 4 months to recover. So when Gabby invited me to perform, I declined on this occasion because, you know, as I said, I had to cancel performances here in Ireland and cancel my coaching.
Okay.
So I've had wonderful care, but I am 100%
good.
Better. So please God, next year.
Great. Oh, that'd be lovely. When we spoke previously, you had just started writing your own material and you were starting to release it. So how has that been going for you?
Oh, it's been going very well. A lot of, like your kind self, a lot of radio stations around the world have played my songs. Mm-hmm. Now, as I said, early in 2023, everything was on hold. But I have my Christmas EP half written.
Okay.
So I am recording 4 more original songs. So I'll have a Christmas CD, hopefully ready.
Brilliant.
By early November to put out into the world.
Fantastic.
And I have church music written as well. So I'm hoping in the new year, that's one of my projects, to do a church music album.
Okay.
And maybe visit some churches and do a performance. So that's in the pipeline.
Great.
As well.
Lovely.
You know, so it's all keeping busy. And I have a collaboration coming with a lovely lady over in the UK, a virtual collaboration.
Wow.
With a lady called Caitlin Gray.
Okay.
We have recorded Tell Him, the iconic duet.
Yes.
With Celine Dion. I'm Celine Dion. Yay. And she's brilliant. Barbra Streisand. So that shall be winging its way to you.
Lovely.
When it's ready, we still have to do the voices are recorded, but we still have to do the video part.
Okay.
So all that is happening. So thank God, back in action and very busy.
And I know, as you say, you haven't been doing a whole lot of live stuff, but have you live performances planned apart from the churches, maybe with the church music?
Yes. I think I told you before, I've written a one-woman show.
Yes.
Called 15. And it's all about being young and in love in the 80s and house phones and boyfriends and standing outside the cinema hoping he'll turn up.
Okay, all right.
Good old days. So there's 15 original songs in that, and there's dialogue. So I am doing a big night for the Recovery Haven here. Do you know the cancer?
Okay.
When you have cancer, you go to this lovely place to recover. So I'm doing a night for them in the Rose Hotel in Tralee. I'm performing 15.
Okay.
And giving them funds for that, for their vital services.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's great. Oh, okay. And yeah, as you said, you're 100% better after your little accident in January. So I presume you'll be adding more to that over the next 6, 8, 12 months.
Oh, I will. I'm hoping to get it out on the road, you know, to get it into a few theatres.
Lovely, lovely.
And yeah. And then, of course, I'm back doing my vocal coaching.
Great.
With my I have adult singing groups. So I do that. And then we do a Christmas performance. You know, there's no point in coming to a class every week if you don't have a goal.
Correct.
We perform at Christmas and we, again, choose a charity. And we raise funds at Christmas.
Lovely.
For them. So last year we did the defibrillators.
Oh, yes. Okay. Which are great. Yeah.
So we raised a bit of money. And last summer, 12 months, I raised money for the pugs. I have a little pug. His name is Dexter. And we have a Siberian Husky.
Right.
Cassie's we raise money for the pugs in the UK.
Great. Lovely.
For the rescue pugs.
Lovely.
So this year we'll be choosing, I usually leave it up to the group to choose something, a vital charity of their choosing. And we all, I waive my own fee and we just sing and we throw around the bucket and we raise some money at
Fantastic.
Christmas.
That's magic. Yeah. Killarney obviously is your base. Killarney is one of the hottest tourist spots in the country. We're just into September now. Has it quietened down a little bit for you?
No. It's very busy. It's very. My husband was out in Mukrasabi yesterday, and he said he met people actually from Holland. He met people from America. He met people from the UK. He said it was buzzing.
Wow. Wow. I remember many years ago being in Killarney, and I can't remember what I was at. I was at something and I was getting a taxi back to the hotel, and I commented, I asked the taxi driver, was it always this busy? And he said, 7 nights a week, it's as busy as it is right now. And I was thinking, Saturday night in Ennis isn't as busy as that, not to mind seven nights a week. So it's nonstop, isn't it?
Oh, it's nonstop in Killarney. There's always something.
Yeah,
there'll be
great.
Something. Now we had a big trad night during the week. It was a massive thing outside the INEC. But then you see Killarney town gets the value of that, because people obviously go into a restaurant or go into a pub in town, and obviously the hotels. No, it is
One of the great things that I know about Killarney, because obviously I would have been there many times, is that if you go into a shop or you go into a pub or a restaurant and you want something particular and they don't have it there, they won't just say, I don't have it. They'll say, I don't have it, but Johnny McGrath, three doors down, has it. And they'll send you somewhere. They won't send you out the door if they can't sell you something else. They won't send you out the door. They will send you to a place. And I like that about Killarney. You look after each other.
Oh, they do. They do. Even on Twitter there, you see one restaurant might tweet about another restaurant. It's like the Tatler Jack here in Killarney. They've recently had a wonderful refurb. They're right. After expanding their business. And a lot of restaurants have tweeted even or liked their picture on Facebook, you know, and shared it.
Yeah,
so
there
is a wonderful vibe in Killarney of looking out for each other.
Before we play this song and let everybody else enjoy it, tell me, what does it mean to you having won this 2 years in a row? It must give you great confidence, does it?
Oh, Ger, it means the world, because, you know, in Ireland, you're constantly grafting and grinding and trying to get out there. But I even met a lovely American man over in Holland, and he said it means the world to be recognised outside your own country.
Mm.
You know, especially, and my son even said to me, and especially when it's your own song.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, it's wonderful to sing covers. But when you write a song from scratch and then you throw it out into the world to be judged and then to win, it's an amazing, it's life changing for confidence, because at the moment now I feel on top of the world. I feel I could go anywhere and sing.
And why wouldn't you?
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
It just changes the perspective of life, really.
All right. And when you won this award, is it just the voice that you won it for, or does the song that you're singing have a particular slant on it as well? Is there something about the song, or is it just the voice?
Well, to answer your question, last year it was my voice, just my voice. There was no song, but this year they changed the rules. So for the voice this year, the song Stargazing was attached onto the category.
Okay.
So it was Stargazing that won that category.
All right.
For me.
And tell me, what's the song about? Remind us. I know you told us the last time. So for anyone that wasn't listening previously.
The song is looking back, I suppose. Looking back when you're young and in love. And you're wondering why things didn't work out when you're young. It's really, I suppose it's nostalgic. You're sitting there, as I suppose we've all done. I know I have. And you're looking at the sky and the stars are beautiful. And you've probably done this 30 years ago with someone when you're in love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what it's about. And you're saying, oh, my God, I'm wondering, why didn't that work out?
Yeah.
But it's just a nostalgic look back
Lovely.
On life.
All right. Well, listen, again, congratulations on winning the award, yet another award, and continued success to you. We look forward to hearing the collaboration, and we look forward to the Christmas EP and everything else that you know you're pushing an open door. So let's take a listen to Stargazing from Mary Cullerty O'Sullivan. Thanks a million, Mary.
Thank you so much, Ger. Thank you.
Mary Cullerty O'Sullivan, congratulations again to Mary on the award that she won. And thanks for joining me on the programme. Always a joy to have Mary on the programme. I'm going to take a very quick break. Come back to me in just a moment, please, if you would. I have more news and I have more great music for you to hear.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
That's a quote from a man by the name of John Gilligan that you may have heard about on Monday in the news. A new book about Gilligan called The Gilligan Tapes has been released by Jason O'Toole, who joins me via Zoom from Madrid. Jason, good to talk to you and thank you for joining us on the programme. How are you today?
I'm great, Ger. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
Delighted to do so. And I suppose the week that's in it, it was very apt that we got a chance because John Gilligan walked free from a court in Torrevieja on Monday afternoon with a suspended sentence. And that made big news in Ireland. And I'm assuming it made equally big news in parts of Spain. He's notorious, I suppose, is the way that you could maybe think about this. Why did you want to talk to John Gilligan?
Okay, this is a bit of a long answer, but back in the noughties, 2007 or so, I had interviewed Giovanni Di Stefano, who claimed to be a solicitor at the time. He was based in Rome. I flew over to interview him for Hot Press magazine on their dime. And his clients included Saddam Hussein, Milosevic, a lot of high-profile English murderers, and also Paddy Holland and John Gilligan. And I had, years before that, watched The General, the John Boorman film, and loved it, just fell in love with the film.
That's about the criminal Martin Cowell.
Yeah, exactly. But I felt it was unrealistic. And when I started to write for Hot Press, I was looking at all the crime writing at the time, and it was all from the perspective. Now, don't get me wrong, it's a valid perspective, but of the guards and victims. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing come from the horse's mouth of the criminals. So I said I'd love to show a realistic portrait of these criminals. So I asked Giovanni, could he set up an interview with Gilligan for me? And he said, I'll come back to you. And a few months later, he rang me from Iraq. And he could have been at home, crumbling paper in his hand, pretending to be in Iraq, saying that he subsequently got 10 years in prison in London for fraud. But he set up the interview. He said, you're on the guest list, so to speak. Go down to Portlaoise prison next week and you can visit Gilligan. So I went down the next week. I interviewed Gilligan over the space of 2 hours. And then a couple of nights later, Gilligan rang me from his prison cell for about 4 or 5 hours. And we got through a lot of material. And I ended up doing a 13,000 word piece. So that was like 14 or 15 pages of a magazine.
Wow.
Over 2 editions. And he was happy with that. And then in 2013, I should say Hot Press was subsequently banned from the prison system because of this article.
Well,
and the Minister for Justice at the time, Dermot O'Hearn, demanded an investigation into how I got into the prison in the first place.
Okay.
So it caused huge controversy, and I think Gilligan got a kick out of that. And then in 2013, Gilligan rang me when he was released from Portlaoise prison after serving 17 years of a 28-year sentence for smuggling cannabis into the country. Mm-hmm. And he asked to meet me, and we met. And this was the week after there was an attempt on his life. So I was pretty nervy about meeting him. And he turned up in disguise.
Yeah.
In a hat, glasses. It was kind of comical in retrospect to the meeting. And it was in a gentleman's club that I was a member of at the time in Dublin. He came in the back door and I had a private room booked, and he came in looking like this, like a coal man almost. It was just comical. And I think he actually had a fake mustache, believe it or not.
Right.
And so he said to me, I want you to write my life story. And I said, okay. And we talked about it. And he said, but I'm not going to talk about being a drug dealer, being a drug baron, whatever you want to call it. And I said, well, we can't do a book. I said, that'd be like interviewing, you know, Neil Armstrong and not asking him about
the moon,
the elephant in the room, you know. It's ridiculous. So we parted company. We had a few meetings at the time, even one in London in the Reform Club. And we chatted away, but it didn't come to anything. And I thought I'd never meet him again. So in last year, he phoned Hot Press magazine and left a voicemail asking for me. Now, I hadn't worked for that magazine for a few years, but Right. And I have a great relationship with Niall Stokes, who runs the magazine. He's been a great mentor to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they sent me through the message. So I was wondering, why the hell was Gilligan looking for me? Because a couple of weeks previously, it was Veronica Guerin's 25th anniversary of her murder. Mm-hmm. And I'd written a nasty piece about Gilligan in the Mirror. It wasn't a very pleasant piece. I was a columnist at the time for them.
Right.
And I thought he was ringing me up to complain about that. But he was really ringing me to ask me, would I be considered doing a book on him? And I said, I wouldn't do a book with you, because he was talking about, would I kind of ghostwrite his memoir?
Okay.
Or something like that. I said, no, that's not going to happen. I said, nobody will publish a book written by you. And he was kind of taken aback by that. But he accepted it.
Okay.
And I said, but I would do a book on you, but I won't be your mouthpiece,
yes.
So, you know, whatever. And he said, okay, you can do a book on me. But then I said to him, would you allow me to record all the interviews on camera? And he was very hesitant at first. He
Go
said,
ahead.
I'm going to have to think about that, because I don't want to be a rat, he said. And I said, I'm not asking you to do punditry. I'm not asking you to be like Eamon Dunphy with the sports, you know, talking about the Guinness or the Monk or whatever. I'm asking about your life story. And that relaxed him a bit. So he came back to me a few days later and said, okay, I'll do it. You have my word. And he said, you can go out and buy your cameras. Don't worry, I won't let you down.
Okay.
So I went out and bought two cameras, figured out how to use them. I went down to Torre Vieja, which I know you probably know very well.
Mm-hmm.
I booked into a hotel and for 5 days. And I thought I'd be finished within the week. I thought I'd have it all over. I thought I'd just sit there and yap with him. But it's mentally draining after 2 or 3 hours interviewing a criminal, no matter how nice they're going to be to you. And obviously, Gilligan put his best foot forward, but it is still mentally draining. So I think after the first week, I had about 10 or 11 hours on tape of video. And the first hour was a disaster because I'm an amateur. I knew I was an amateur net then, but I'm a semi-amateur now. Mm. I knew nothing about how to record people. So I put him up against the window and recorded it.
Okay.
And he looked like one of these characters from Crime Line, silhouette.
Yeah.
The first thing. So I couldn't see him. It was just like darkness, like a person you're trying to, that was trying to protect their identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, but the audio was great. And the audio from the first day was the
Talk Radio Europe.
Everybody's in quoting Spain.
It. I don't believe in God, but I know I'm going to hell, mm-hmm. which is a pretty true statement. It's the most accurate statement Gilligan has made in his life. So the next day, I repositioned him on the other side of the room because I rang a photographer and I said, how the hell do I do this properly? And he explained it all to me. And a lot of that footage was used last night, which was great. So I had to keep going back. So I'd go back to Torre Vieja for 4 or 5 days each time. And it was really a pain going back each time because I'm based in Madrid. So you have to get a train, then you have to get a bus, and you're carrying all this.
You're carrying the gear, yeah.
Yeah, and you're on your own, and you're being secretive. I mean, I kept this secret for 18 months in total, 12 months on my own, and then a team came in to help me. So it was just monotonous going back and forward and time-consuming. But it had to be done because after the first trip, I went away and I transcribed the tapes. And incidentally, the AI machines do not work on John Gilligan with Dublin the Mackler, because I used to write music profile pieces for the Mirror, and you'd get 70% or 80% right with the English or the American bands that you interview. When you put the tape into the computer system, it would transcribe it pretty accurately. But with Gilligan, it was doing 20-30% max. At one stage, he was talking about a serious crime, and it came up that he was talking about a private part of his body that he thought was lovely,
oh, yeah.
which was not true, you know. So the tapes were could not be translated by the system. Right. So I had to type them in the video, you know, manually. Yeah. And that was very time consuming.
I bet it was. Jason, let me start not at the start, but or at the end by any stretch of the imagination. But let's start where the majority of people in Ireland came to know who John Gilligan was. And that was after the murder of Veronica Guerin. And yes. To this day, he says that he had nothing to do with that. And he blames a man who is no longer alive. In your book, he names the man who ordered the killing and the man who pulled the trigger and who drove the motorcycle. Names which will be familiar to Irish people particularly, but to anybody that knows this particular story. How soon into your conversation with John Gilligan did you introduce Veronica Guerin?
Oh, the first day.
Good.
I tried to do everything chronologically, in the sense that I tried to start the interviews from when he was born to now, in chronological order. Mm. But I couldn't resist going diving straight into you know, Veronica Guerin, because you know it's all well and good what he says what he wants to say, but we have to remember. A mother of a young child was brutally murdered,
mm-hmm.
And by his gang. He's confessed to me that for the first time that they were all members of his gang, but he says it wasn't his gang, in a twisted kind of way. He says that they're all sole traders, which I found bizarre. He compared it to being a supermarket, but I do believe. Quite a lot of what he has to say about the murder, because a lot of what he has to say makes sense.
All right. And when he talks about it, I saw from the first episode of, and to explain to listeners, Virgin Media in Ireland is currently putting three nights together. So there's two gone as this has been broadcast, and there's a final one this evening. It's basically the tapes that you made when you were sitting with Gilligan, and he has deadpan eyes. He's got deadpan face, which I presume he has perfected over the years. But as you spoke to him about Veronica Guerin's murder, did you see any flinch or twitch?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course I did.
Okay.
What did you think of the show last night overall?
I thought it was very informative. And, you know, looking at Gilligan on screen, it's hard to imagine that this small man, and he's small in stature by all accounts, could inflict what he has inflicted and become what he became and manage to amass what he amassed. I think he says that he was robbing from the age of 8 and he's now 71, I think, and he's still at it. And the question that I had actually in relation to it was, is he a glory hunter? Is that why he's doing this?
Yeah, I mean, my producer of the show, and thanks, that was very nice comments you made about the show. My producer, David Harvey, who's on the board of RTE.
David, yeah. And
yeah, he did Crime Line, that he was a presenter of Crime Line. He said he's narcissistic and egotistical, you know?
Mm.
And I can absolutely see where David's coming from. The, you know, Gilligan's motives for doing this documentary are very clear to me. He's 71 years of age, as you pointed out, by his own admission, he probably doesn't have many years left before he shuffles off this mortal coil.
Mm-hmm.
He really feared he was going to prison yesterday for the charges in Spain. So he feared dying behind bars, which was a headline from the serialization in the Irish Mirror and the Star the other day. I don't want to die behind bars or whatever the quote the headline. But he wanted to tell his side of the story. And obviously, I reckon he settled some old scores in the process when it comes to Brian Meehan, you know, John Traynor and Charlie Bowden.
Mm-hmm.
It is about legacy. It is about finally having the confidence and the ability to tell his side of the story, because he didn't know who to turn to during the last 15 or 20 years. And then when he met me in Hot Press, and I didn't twist his words, I published the article verbatim, his quotes, He started to trust me and eventually came out of his shell. But that took a long time because, as I said to you, when I met him in 2013, he wasn't willing to talk about his criminal enterprise. Mm. It's only now he's willing to talk about it. And that's because he feared he was going to go to prison yesterday and would never get the opportunity to speak about it again.
In the quote, or just after the quote of him not believing in God but knows he's going to hell, he said that he wanted to do the interviews for the sake of his family. What did he mean by that? Does he want them to remember him fondly or something?
Yeah, well, he doesn't want the media hammering him left, right and centre.
Okay.
So he's hoping that this will change the public's perception of him. And I told him, don't believe in miracles. And that's where that line came from. I'm going to hell.
Yeah.
Because that was the first thing I said to him. You shouldn't believe in miracles because I don't believe the perception is definitely in the media. It's never going to change about you. And he said, well, I don't believe in God. I know I'm going to hell. Mm. So he did it for his family because he was really hoping that, you know, the perception would change, but I know it will change about certain parts of his life. You know, people will probably feel sorry for the guy, and they should, that in this sense that his father was a very abusive father and bet the hell out of him, bet the hell out of his mother and his sisters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a horrible upbringing. You wouldn't wish that on anybody.
No.
So there is sympathy for him there. Well, you've got to remember, I mean, he put his best foot forward here in these interviews. He is an intelligent, sometimes even charming, charismatic sometimes even, and he's a funny guy, and he's, you know, he's clearly a resourceful man. You know, but with John, everything is about the bottom line. He's not he is definitely not some kind of working class hero like a Robin Hood,
yes,
type of character. He's not. Okay, he was a helpless victim at the beginning, but he's not a helpless victim of fate or society. This is not a sob story overall. He had plenty of opportunities to walk away from his life of crime. John Gilligan, by his own self-confession here, chose to be a criminal. He chose to act in this manner. I really feel this is a portrait of a crime and a master criminal who sowed the dragon's teeth of the Kinnens. So we went from Gilligan to the Kinnahans. It's a bit like what the Dunn said. If you think we're bad, you should see what's coming next.
Correct. Correct. I thought about that quote last night when I was watching the piece on TV and Larry Dunn was featured. And I thought, there you go. There's a line for when I'm chatting with Jason, but you got there.
I know Christy Dunn quite well. I spent a week hanging out with him for an interview.
So did you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I've interviewed lots of the criminals. I did a book about 12 or 13 years ago. John Borman's company, Maryland, published it called Crime Inc. And it was an anthology of my interviews in Hot Press. I spent 2 years for Hot Press interviewing all these guys from the underworld. I went into this heart of darkness and it was disturbing. I came out of it as a... having panic attacks after it was so disturbing.
Jeepers.
Because I got a few death threats. And you're the first person I ever said that to. But I interviewed Gilligan, Dutchie Holland, Fat Puss, Christy Dunn, several members of the IRA, prominent members of the IRA, including Bobby Storey and Jerry Kelly, Jerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, and not just once. I'd go back to
no, just for legal reasons. Can we point out that Jerry Adams has always denied that he was ever a member of the IRA?
Absolutely, you should.
Yeah.
And,
just to cover ourselves.
Well, I mean, interviewing all these. So it was a 300-something page book. It was a big book with all these interviews, and. I went down to Limerick to My Ross to interview criminals, drug dealers. So I did a lot of exploring, a lot of diving into the underworld. And it was an interesting experience, but it wasn't good for my mental health, put it that way.
No, I can imagine. Let me ask you a question in relation to the coverage and the exposure that the book got over the last, over the weekend, particularly on many of the newspapers in Ireland, where Veronica Guerin, let's say this, that Veronica Guerin's family, her brother Jimmy in particular, has been to the forefront of condemning anything to do with Gilligan over the years, as has a lot of the media in Ireland. And the book has been criticised for glorifying John Gilligan, in their words. How do you answer that? Or does that upset you?
No, it doesn't upset me, but I do have a good answer. And I wouldn't say, I think you're a bit unfair there to me when you say a lot of the media.
Okay.
I think it's a minority of the media, but it is a loud voice.
No, sorry, just to clarify, what I meant was a lot of the media would blame Gilligan for Veronica's, not that a lot of media were attacking you, but that...
Sorry, maybe I misunderstood.
Yeah, my apologies, just in case you know, that wasn't my intent. So anyway, you said that you have a good answer for it.
Yeah, you know, to be honest with you, I sympathise with Veronica's family. Mm. Jimmy has spent... really dedicated his life to keeping the flame of her spirit alive. And I admire that, truly admire that, okay? And he was invited to come on the show. He turned it down. He was invited several times because he decided a while back that he was going to stop talking about her. And I can appreciate that. Mm. But the thing is, if you look, my producer on this project, David Harvey, was, I think since the age of 19, a close friend of Veronica's. In fact, during my first meeting with him to discuss the documentary, he showed me a picture of them together as young, as you know, in their early 20s. Uh-huh. And he would not set out to desecrate the memory of someone he respected and valued as a friend.
No.
David Harvey wanted, like me, to get Gilligan finally to speak on the record about his life and the crime, and then we could dissect what he had to say for himself. And there's so many startling revelations in this. And the proof of the pudding in a lot of ways is we got senior Gardaí members to agree to cooperate and appear in this documentary. They would never have agreed to appear in this documentary if they felt it was going to desecrate her memory. Michael O'Sullivan, the assistant, the former assistant Garda commissioner, mm-hmm. Felix McKenna, the head of CAB, they're all in this documentary. They knew what they were getting themselves into. And I think it's very positive because this documentary, we got Gilligan to speak on the record. He finally, amidst the many startling revelations, confessing that he was a drug dealer, that he did smuggle guns into the country, that he did hit his ex-wife, that yes, one of his close friends, Dutchie Holland, was a hitman, and so on. So from that perspective, it is a worthy project because... Mm. He's finally saying stuff that he would never admit in the past.
Right. Let's talk about John Gilligan then, and tell us who he is. And because we've talked about, you know, the important, and when I say important, the stuff that brought him to our attention and how you and he sat down together and that. So who is John Gilligan? What do we learn about him in this book and by watching the three episodes?
Yeah. Can I just make one extra point?
Of course you can, please, yeah.
Now, regards, there's been three ministers in the last couple of days have come out against the documentary and the book, okay? Mostly against the documentary, in fairness. I don't think they've come out against the book. Mm. But I want to make this point. I was surprised to read that these three government ministers criticised the doc. I kind of felt like I was trapped in an episode of Father Ted with his kind of, you know, down with this sort of thing, mm-hmm. man. I wonder if they even believe in free speech. These ministers weren't up in arms when Malcolm MacArthur conducted interviews for a book. Why not? I also think it would have been good to have a minister for justice and a minister for drugs to be smart enough to watch a documentary on one of Ireland's biggest drug barons. They are both utterly kind of losing the wars, their wars in their government portfolios. The first principle of war, in my opinion, is to know your enemy. Their actions and attitudes go a long way towards explaining why they're losing their wars. Mm. A minister for justice and a minister for drugs should be embarrassed not to be watching a portrait of crime like this.
Because it does lay open the character and the mindset, and you can apply that to the others, can't you?
Yeah, and I've got to say one more thing. I was I wasn't going to say it, but I'm tempted and I will say it. And, you know, when it comes to the freedom of speech, these guys don't believe in freedom of speech. There was an instance a few years ago when I wrote a very, very critical column on Minister McEntee, and someone in her team, I won't mention her name for legal reasons, demanded that the paper I was writing for at the time take down the opinion piece from their website. And the piece was taken down without the editor's knowledge. And that to me is a form of censorship. So, you know, the program is stuffed with senior respected guards and they all felt it was okay. I'm just really surprised by three ministers saying they didn't think it was a good idea to interview these people, because if we don't listen to these people like Gilligan, we're not going to learn anything. We need to listen to them.
And you can decide when you're watching it and reading the book, you can decide what you believe yourself or what you would disagree with. But as you say, the important thing is to listen and to have an open mind.
Well, yes. And look, the Irish Times today wrote a review on it and they said, Gilligan does not come out of this documentary looking well at all. What do you think? Does he come out of it looking well?
Well, I've only seen the first episode. As I said, I had those questions in my head as I was watching it, and I would be very interested. I mean, the first episode is always one that whets your appetite and you say, okay, what's going to happen in number two and number three? So I'm very much looking forward to watching the third one, and I'll happily let you know when I have seen it, whether I think he comes out of it well or not. But the question, I suppose you answered the most important question I had in my head last night when I was looking at it and saying, is this guy a glory hunter? Is this what this is all about? It's a swan song. And so far that is, no, and that wouldn't be a good thing in my opinion. But if he lays his soul bare, like you say he does, and he does in the book, and admits to doing certain things, well then sure, you can come out good or looking good in those circumstances, irrespective of why you did it and what your upbringing was and so on.
Yeah, but he's not going to come out looking good when he says, I don't care.
No.
Heard that Veronica Guerin was murdered. I mean, she was the mother of a young child.
Of course.
And he says that. So he doesn't come out of the documentary looking good from that perspective. He might come out of the documentary looking funny on occasion, because he tries to be funny and smart. And he can be quite funny on occasion with what he says. Mm. He does have a good sense of humor. But He you can see when I'm in his presence, you can see why he was probably perceived as the most dangerous man in Ireland in the 80s and 90s.
Can you feel that when you're there beside him or in front of him?
Yeah, you can feel it. You feel that you're in that presence.
Hmm. Interesting. Because just to look at him... And as I said, the deadpan face, the deadpan voice, there's danger lurking, I would imagine, not very far under the surface.
Yeah, but at the same time, he can be, you know, put his best foot forward, and he can be, you know, the most friendliest person, you know, charm personified when you meet him.
Take us through who he is then and how he came up through the ranks to become who he became.
Well, he grew up in Ballyfermot. He quickly, you know, went from being, you know, a petty thief to an armed robber, and then breaking into factories. And then when he started to break into factories, he actually soon enough became the biggest in Ireland for this. I mean, at one stage in the 80s, he stole £1 million worth of VHS machines. And just for a kick, when he stole them, he went down to Grafton Street and bought one.
That's right.
£1,000 at the time. And he took the receipt and put it, sellotaped it to underneath the VHS machine, knowing the guards would come into his house the next day.
Yeah.
And he says this in the book, that he got a great kick out of the guards ripping the house apart, seeing the VHS machine and going, rubbing their hands together in glee and saying, we've got you, you're an awful idiot. And he says, look underneath the machine. And they see the receipt and their mouths drop. And he got away with that. So he admits the crimes in the book that he got away with. And he has tampered with evidence. He's stolen evidence out of a court. That's how brazen he is.
Wow.
Yeah, it's in the book. He stole, he asked to see exhibits in the court, and he had fake ones in his pockets and switched them. And they couldn't do him on it. And there's several incidents like that where he's the most hilarious one. I know we don't want to make him out to be a comedian, but this is an hilarious story. He was in Limerick to steal the mail train, and he robbed all these bags off the mail train, and the guards came into his room with submachine guns pointing them at his face, went and woke him up and arrested him. And the other two guys went best and did a deal, but he wouldn't do a deal. So he went to court and he represented himself, and he said, "I'd like to see the exhibits, please." And the judge said, "Yes, you're entitled to see the exhibits." Guards, where are the exhibits? And the guards went silent, and then they said, "We posted them back." So there was no exhibits, and he was found not guilty.
Wow. Wow. That is something, isn't it? You did mention that he was, you know, he demonstrates at times that he was, that he is intelligent, that he is clever. And I suppose examples like that would copper fasten that idea. But is he a man that has lived on his wits, or has all this been planned and mapped out?
Oh, nothing in Gilligan's life is mapped out. He's a gambler, born gambler. You know, he just puts it all in red or black or evens or odds, you know, like on a roulette table, and he goes for it. He lives on adrenaline. He loves the buzz of being in tight spots.
Okay. Even
yesterday, he rang me at 6 o'clock in the morning or 6:30 in the morning when he was going to court for the case. And he said to me, "There's a 50-50 chance here. I'll get off, I'll get prison." And it was like he was putting a bet on something.
Is he finished?
Ah, yeah. He's a busted flush.
Is he?
Absolutely. I think he's afraid to get involved in crime now. He knows, as I said before to you, 1 year in prison is the equivalent of 7 years in a dog life at the age of 71. So I don't think he's going to get involved in crime again. But he has to make a living somewhere. At the moment, he's living off betting. He will put on a 300 euro bet on Liverpool versus some crappy team, or Man United versus some crappy team. And you normally get 100 euro or 80 euro back off that. And he'll bet like that every day. So right. That's how he's living at the moment.
They say, or it is said about him, that he has millions stashed. Has he?
No, absolutely not. It's impossible. I've seen his lifestyle over the year. He's wearing the same suit that he came out of prison in, and you know the treads have kind of they've worn down. That there's buttons broken on the suit. He doesn't have much money.
Really?
No. No, really, that's truthfully. And it's quite cheap to live in Torrevieja. He's paying $550 a month for his villa. And okay. It's not even a great villa. You probably know yourself, you can rent a place between $500 and $650 a month out there.
Mm-hmm.
So he's living on his wits' end, and he doesn't have much money. And at the moment, the last couple of months, and I would testify in court to this, it's all being gambling he's living off.
Where does he stand on the whole Kinahan Hutch debacle, I suppose you could call it? Has he an opinion? Has he an interest in it? What?
No, he won't talk about it at all. Absolutely won't. But this is, you know, he is the master criminal who sold the dragon's teeth to Kinahan's. He talks about being in prison with Kinahan, with Christie Sr. He doesn't really know the monk that well. Their paths didn't cross that much. But he won't get into it. I mean, it's been alleged that it was the Kinahans who ordered and organised the hit on him. Back in 2014, Gilligan was shot 6 times out in his brother's house and survived to tell the tale. He even had the last rites. So he won't go into them whatsoever. So I'm sorry, my answer can't be more exciting on that subject.
No, not at all. Because it's good to get an insight into, you know, where he's at right now as well, considering where he has been. What was the big learning thing for you when you had done the tapes and written the book and put the programs together? What is the big takeaway for you?
One of them is quite negative for the guards, to be honest with you, on two points. The first point is that, you know, as you know, the guards feed the crime reporters with a lot of information, and nothing about Gilligan's formative years in the books and the documentaries and all the articles that have been written is true, really. They're getting so many facts wrong. And it's all being fed to them by the guards. For example, there's one book where it states that Gilligan learned how to be a criminal in a kind of educational-wise in a school in Mountjoy Prison by Martin Cattle.
Okay.
And John Traynor was there at the same time. He was never in prison with Martin Cattle and John Traynor, he told me. So I believe that. And they say that, you know, the books and the articles and all this stuff says that he then went onto the boats with John Traynor and started stealing with John Traynor in the boats. None of this is true. It's all fictional.
Okay.
So I didn't have any primary sources when I was doing the interviews with Gilligan. I couldn't rely on these books about his formative years. So I found that quite interesting that there was, I know Gilligan has been accused of telling the tissue of lies in his life, but there is a tissue of fabrication or waffle when it comes to trying to explain Gilligan's earlier years. And I think that's one of the best parts of the book, because Gilligan actually explains everything about his earlier years. And I'm sorry for being critical about that to other journalists and writers, but it did shock me that most of it wasn't right.
Mm.
I mean, it just surprised me. I suppose the other, you know, you learn a lot from being with someone like Gilligan. He came across to me a bit like a mixture of the General meets, I suppose, Robert De Niro in The Heat.
Right.
They're very clever guys.
Mm.
But they put their assets, or, you know, their
acumen, to wrong.
You know, he could have been a counsellor, or he could have been a local TD if he'd put his mind in it in a positive and a good way.
One of the questions that I had thought I would put to you was wondering, does he live with one eye over his shoulder? But when you tell me that you and he were meeting for 18 months and nobody discovered it, signaled to me that there's nobody watching him, because if there were, be it law enforcement or other criminals, you would have been seen in his company and questions would have been asked maybe of you, the story would have been out that you were meeting with him. So I'll ask the question anyway. Am I right in my theory that nobody is watching him?
I believe so. I mean, the first week I got a bit paranoid, and I think it was justified. I do believe that the police followed me from the hotel back to the bus station the first week I interviewed him.
Right.
I'm convinced of that. Yeah. But apart from that, no. I think that nobody cared what he was doing. Other criminals might care what he's doing. The police don't care what he's doing.
Okay.
Because they know he's not up to any illegal activities at the moment. And he's not, as far as I know. I think I know him quite well. At this stage, he's just too afraid. He's really afraid of prison. But yeah, he's a busted flush. He's yesterday's man. I'm shocked. I'm really shocked that nobody twigged that we had done all these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
But we kept it. You know, we kept it quite secretive. He didn't tell any of his family not even his partner that he was doing these interviews. And he just come up to the hotel a couple of hours a day, meet me, and he was gone. And that was it, you know. Occasionally, we might have lunch or breakfast together. He would talk to me off the record to brief me on things because he knows I want to write other books in the future on crime.
Okay.
About crime in general, not just about him. So I feel that I got to know a criminal inside out after doing 40 hours on tape, videotape, over 20 more hours on audio. It's a lot more now because he allows me to record all his phone calls to me. And he record at this stage, he phones me a lot.
Okay.
And I'm recording all these conversations. He was phoning me a lot because he feared he was going to prison. So he wanted to make sure that I had enough material if I did a second book. I hope that answers the question.
It does. It's a lot. Absolutely. A lot. Answers the question. Has he any regrets?
The crime? No.
Yeah.
He doesn't care that he robbed factories or banks. He'd say to me, sure, the factories were insured. And, you know, I point out in the book, yeah, sure, the factories were insured, but insurance went up because of you.
Mm.
Across the board. And he just dismissed that. But overall, he has regrets about his personal life that he got into crime. He feels he wasted his life. He wishes he was there more for his family. He really regrets not raising his kids more himself. That's a big regret for him. He really regrets not being with his ex-wife now. I can feel that. I know she's quite upset with him over his life of crime. And that is a big, big, big regret for him that he didn't keep the family unit together. And I can understand that. But he told me, for example, like, which really surprised me, that in the early days when they lived in Corduff, a council estate in Dublin, he would put £800 or £900, a lot of money at the time, more a month's wage really, into his wife's drawer and say, that's for you. And he'd forget about it. And a couple of months later, he'd be broke from gambling because he told me he spent 20 million on gambling. And she'd say, well, that money's still there if you want to spend it. I never touched it. And he told me that his ex-wife wouldn't touch his stolen money, that she wanted nothing to do with stolen money. And he repeatedly told me that. So it, which I thought was an interesting aspect of their relationship. So, yeah, he has regrets about that. He regrets being in prison, obviously. He jokingly says he regrets not wearing gloves. But he's angry with the system. You know, he's angry that people blame him for Cab.
Yes.
Obviously, the Veronica Guerin case is the reason that accelerated the Cab case or the Cab legislation. But he's in denial about that. He says, no, Cab was, you know, originally going to start in 86 where the Cork solicitor, Barry Galvin,
yes,
had written a report, and then he had Barry Galvin in 1992 had appeared in the Late Late Show to talk about this report and about going after the Al Capone type of characters, which was dismissed by Padraig Flynn at the time, the Minister for Justice, as being OTT, which was ridiculous. Padraig Flynn should have, you know, taken the bulls by the horn. And that memo or that legal missive that Galvin had written was used as the basis for the Cab legislation. But Gilligan gets very, very angry when you say Cab started because of you. Now, in the documentary, Felix McKenna says, we wouldn't have started Cab without the murders of McCabe and Veronica. One more thing I have to say, and that, it bores me, the legal stuff, to be honest with you, in the book, but, you know, it has to be put in. The phone calls to Veronica Guerin threatened to sodomize her son. And it was alleged that for the audience, the listeners that don't know this, it was alleged that Gilligan had rang up Veronica Guerin after he had allegedly assaulted her at his property when the doorstep. he had apparently said he would sodomize her son if she went through with the prosecution, and there was a solicitor in her presence. So that drives him absolutely bananas. He says that to me, and he keeps saying to me, please get this across when you're in the book. And the phone calls, he repeatedly claims that if these phone calls were true, he would have been convicted of murder. He says in the criminal case for his the murder case for Fonica Guerin, his team had asked for all the phone calls from her, all the phone calls from him, to see if there had been any phone call from her, from him, or, you know, any other phone call received on that day. And he says that they couldn't find any phone calls, and the judge was satisfied with that. Now, this is before my time. I was a young Cub reporter at this time, so I didn't really pay much attention to the
right
ins and outs of the case. So it'd be interesting to know, if is that true? Did the judge say, I don't believe there was any phone calls made? But he says, Gilligan says, if there's no phone calls made, you know, it helps my case. So, you know, he goes into detail in that in the book about that. But he's adamant about that. It would, if you want to wind Gilligan up, just ask him about cab or the phone calls. You know,
That's something that I would not be interested in doing, winding John Gilligan up, to be honest with you. But there you go. Listen, I got to let you go. You've been extremely kind with your time, generous with your time and with the information. And we didn't give away too much about what's in the book or the documentaries. I'm looking forward to watching the final two episodes, looking forward very much to getting stuck into the book. And I hope that our listeners will be interested enough to buy it, because it's available on our website at tre.radio. We have a virtual bookstore there and our listeners can purchase it there. It's called The Gilligan Tapes. Jason O'Toole, journalist, is the author of that. Jason, thanks ever so much for talking to me, and I wish you well with it. And let this not be the last time that you and I have a chat on the radio.
Oh, Ger, I'd be delighted to come back on your show anytime you want me.
Thanks a million.
Together, together, together. And if I never break, got your own family. And maybe one day when I build my own, I'll remember you said to me, it's been a long
I thought seeing as John Gilligan is going to hell, I thought we'd play Heaven coming out of that interview. And that was an interview with Jason O'Toole. And Jason, I do appreciate the fact that he spent so much time talking to me, because it's nice to have a conversation rather than an interview in that situation and just find out about the author as much as the subject of it and the relationship between the two. And you could hear all of that going on. So I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you to those that have been in touch thus far to say that they have. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said that he will make a decision in the coming weeks on whether to launch a legal challenge against the UK's government's Northern Ireland Legacy Bill. The controversial bill passed its final hurdle at Westminster today after MPs voted to overturn amendments made in the House of Lords, allowing the bill to proceed unchanged. The bill, which will close down all civil and criminal troubles cases, including inquests, from next May, has been vociferously opposed by all victims groups and the political parties. Mr. Varadkar said that Ireland is assessing legal advice on the strength of taking a case over the bill. He said there aren't many things that all of the five main parties in Northern Ireland agree on, but they all agree that this is wrong and this is not victim-centred and not human rights-proofed. Mr. Varadkar said that he has mentioned this to the Prime Minister on many occasions. He said that he will say it again to the Secretary of State when he sees him next week. The Attorney General's preparing some legal advice on what the strength would be of Ireland taking a case to the European Court on Human Rights, essentially saying that this bill, this act, is not compliant with the European Convention on Human Rights, of which Britain is a signatory. The legislation would see an independent commission for reconciliation and information recovery, which would deal with all future troubles cases. It would offer conditional immunity to killers in return for cooperation in establishing the facts of a case. Reports would then be offered to families. Campaigners say it is a cynical ploy to assure British Army veterans that there will be no further prosecutions linked to their time in Northern Ireland. Army veterans have given the legislation a cautious welcome today. I think we're going to hear a whole lot more about that particular story. And I think it's not going to be a short-lived story. No, because it is going to go to court and it is going to go to numerous courts, I would imagine. This is a nice story. A second exhibition of what is claimed to be the world's largest private die-cast model aircraft collection has been unveiled at Shannon Airport. In 2018, Mike Kelly from Limerick City donated 1,500 die-cast model aircraft to the airport from his private collection. They've been part of an aviation exhibition for passengers in the departures lounge. I've seen it. It's lovely. It's absolutely great. Last week, a second exhibition was unveiled in the main terminal building, featuring a further 900 model aircraft donated by Mr. Kelly. He said that since he was a boy, he's now 72, he was fascinated with airplanes and spent many days watching planes come and go at Shannon Airport. Sure, didn't we all do that as children? Aye, and young people. Yes. Estimates that he now has models representing over 90% of the world's airlines and carriers, and also military and rescue jets. Among those is a die-cast model of the famous Antonov 225 cargo plane built by the Kyiv-based Antonov company in the 80s. The plane, which was widely used for humanitarian missions, was destroyed during fighting between Russian and Ukrainian troops in Ukraine in February of 2022. The exhibition It is a fascinating journey through the evolution of aviation dating back to the 1930s and showcases an array of aircraft from every corner of the world. It includes a full collection of Concordes as well as a complete fleet of VC-10s and the legendary Sunderland, once owned by Al Capone. Also includes a full collection of Ryanair and Aer Lingus diecast aircraft. Mr. Kelly estimates that he has spent over €500,000 on the collection over the years. When asked about how much it was worth now, he said that a collector from New York had recently been in contact with him and said that it could be worth up to €4 million. That's fascinating. If you're ever in Shannon Airport, go looking for that. It's in the departure lounge. All right. And listen, that's it. Done and dusted. Mary Connolly O'Sullivan, congratulations again on your recent award. And thank you for joining me on the programme this evening to talk to me about it and to let us hear Stargazer again, or Stargazing. And Jason O'Toole, the author of the Gilligan tapes, thank you very much as well. And good luck with that and the remainder of the documentaries that need to be broadcast. That's my lot for today. Thank you as always to Antonio Sierra. Antonio is our Spanish-Irish cultural advisor on the programme. I am back tomorrow morning on the radio filling in for Giles between 10 and 12. If you can join me for that, that would be brilliant. If not, we'll catch up with you next week. From me, Ger Sweeney. Until then, thanks for listening. Bye-bye now.
Ger Sweeney presents Live on Era in association with emeraldconnection.net.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.